Case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed to the third case of the day, United States versus Martin.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Mr. Hunt?
Yes, my name is Edward John Hunt. I represent Victor Alicia. Let me begin by saying that I feel that the curtailment, the prohibition that Judge Shabazz imposed on Attorney Quinn when she was attempting to cross-examine Maldonado was error, and it was a violation of the right to confront witnesses. Let me clarify something, though, before I go further in that argument. The government mistakenly, and I emphasize mistakenly, makes the claim that Ms. Quinn at no time moved to strike that testimony. I say mistakenly because I think it was an unintentional misstep by them. They missed that portion of the transcripts, section, it's docket 314, page 212, in which Ms. Quinn clearly moved for striking the testimony. Having said that, I don't think that striking the testimony would have solved the problem here. And so I'm not really concentrating on that aspect of it that relates to striking the testimony. I'm asking, Your Honors, for reversal of the conviction, and reversal of the conviction simply because Ms. Quinn was attempting to cross-examine this witness on an important area, a pass of approximately six people that he was involved in drug transactions for, and that the police were aware of this. I think it would have demonstrated bias if she'd been allowed to explore that issue. She was not, unfortunately. Now, Your Honor, I'd like to turn to what I think is the most important issue in this case, or one of the most important issues. That is Judge Shabazz's decision to apply an obstructing enhancement under 3C, under 3C,
1-1?
I'm sorry, 1.1.
Well, we deal with it maybe a little more than you.
It was clearly error for the following reasons. It was not willful. The statement was not material. The magistrate, who had a chance to observe the demeanor of the witness, at most said, at the evidentiary hearing, Alicia denied that he ever gave consent for the search, but I didn't and don't believe him. But this is very important. The magistrate went on to say, this, however, does not shift the government's burden of persuasion to Alicia. I think the magistrate was saying that he didn't find any of that material. There are cases that are discussed and cited which discuss the opportunities that district courts have at evidentiary hearings to assess demeanor. This isn't a case where Magistrate Crocker was saying, this man lies, and I found it was willful, and I found it interfered with the administration of justice. He just had that remark and went on to rule that consent wasn't voluntary. Now, there's an interesting subtext to this. At first, the pre-sentence writer agreed with the government that an obstructing enhancement should be added. But later, in an addendum, after they considered Ms. Quinn's compelling arguments that it wasn't willful, wasn't material, wasn't part and parcel of this hearing, or at least the judge's analysis, and that the judge had not said that Mr. Alicia had lied, and also in reliance on that important note 2 to 3C1.1, which analyzes that there are cases where somebody may testify and it's not necessarily false, could be anxiety, could be mistake. The pre-sentence writer changed his original conclusion to add the obstructing. The pre-sentence writer agreed that it wasn't material. Judge Shabazz said, without really engaging in a clear analysis, that he was finding that it was material, although it's still unclear how he finds it was material. And as this court is aware, Judge Shabazz ultimately rejected Magistrate Crocker's recommendation for suppression of the gun. Now, the gun is important in terms of the other error, and the final issue I'd like to address. This court, the district court, erroneously applied Section 2D1.1B1. Now, I realize I have a heavy burden in that regard to demonstrate to this court, because it's beyond dispute there was a gun that Victor Alicia had during the operative period of the conspiracy. But I think you have to pay attention, close attention, to what Adam Young, the witness who didn't testify at trial but was called at sentencing, says about this gun. And what he doesn't say. There's no indication that Victor Alicia ever used a gun during any drug transaction, no indication that drugs were found near the gun. The conversation about the gun, the display of the gun, was in the context of some movie, that the gun looked like a gun that was in a movie. I hope I'm pronouncing the gun make correctly. I'm not a gun person. The gun itself was a Rutger. All right. Now, it's true. Adam Young did identify a picture at the sentencing hearing of that gun. But that's not to say that the government carried the day in demonstrating that it was clearly improbable that the gun wasn't used in connection with the drug offense. I submit it was clearly improbable because there is no nexus. In so many of the cases that this court and other courts have relied on in deciding whether a gun is used in the context of a conspiracy, there's some nexus. There's drugs. There's aiding a co-conspirator.
Do we have Victor displaying it to a buyer at one point?
No, there's nothing like that, Your Honor.
Doesn't that what the government alleges?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, if they do make that direct claim, but the only person...
They don't say it was during a drug deal. They just say that he showed it to a buyer.
Right. Now, inferentially what they say is that by showing that, he was sending some implicit message, don't mess with me. But there was never any explicit message. And the context of the conversation certainly doesn't demonstrate that the gun enhancement is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Mr. Berman.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Morris Berman, and I was appointed to represent another Alicia, Melvin Alicia, in the district court and represent him on this appeal. Mr. Hunt also addressed an issue that was raised in Melvin Alicia's appeal, and that was also the two-level enhancement that the district court imposed under 2D1.1B for possessing firearms. There is no dispute that there was a series of purchases in about a two-year span of time by Melvin Alicia of firearms, but there was no evidence that Melvin Alicia ever displayed it in the context of a drug transaction, that guns were found in proximity to any drugs, that he ever brandished it or directly threatened a buyer or potential buyer with it. There is one notation in the pre-sentence report of a display of a gun, which is never linked to one of the purchased guns by Melvin Alicia. This was at a poker game to a Mr. Perry Zubchek, who then expressed to Melvin Alicia, I don't like guns, it was promptly put away. That's the last mention of any guns in the pre-sentence, and yet there was this two-level enhancement. Again, I think without repeating what Mr. Hunt so ably presented to the court in terms of a nexus, while the guideline admittedly doesn't require a nexus, I would point out that in a recent case relied heavily upon by the government in its brief, Bjorkman, this court at page 492 of that opinion wrote that under 3B1.1, the government bears the burden to prove an aggravating circumstance that the defendant possessed a weapon in a place where drugs were present, and then the burden shifts to show the clear improbability. That isn't the case here with Melvin Alicia. There's no indication that the poker game was anything but a poker game. No indication that it was even at Melvin Alicia's residence. There was a sort of implied connection posed by the government that somehow this is linked to a threat to this Mr. Sutton. But Mr. Sutton never said he saw a gun. Mr. Sutton never said anything about a gun. And so I think that furthers our argument of the clear improbability. I don't want to infringe on the time of other counsel. We did raise another argument as the enhancement for the 3C1.1 obstruction. I think the authorities are well set out in the brief that this was not a willful obstruction, if any obstruction was shown at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. Mr. Dutch?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Court. Counsel? My name is Gregory Dutch, and I represent Douglas Martin in this case. Your Honors, at 2 o'clock in the morning, approximately in January of 1999, there was a question posed to my client by a young woman named Lisa Templin. Question: what would the price of a kilo of cocaine be? Reply by my client at a hotel party: most he could obtain would be 1/2 kilo. There was no price talked about, no callback, no further negotiations, no agreement. One week later, my client and the same Lisa Templin are at a party where where Lisa Templin purchases an 8-ball, 1/8 quarter ounce of cocaine. Again, no talk about 1/2 kilo, no talk about a price, no talk about an agreement. Based on that statement, Judge Shabazz determined that Lisa Templin could obtain 500 grams from my client, Doug Martin, and therefore increased my client's relevant conduct from 46 grams to 546 grams, thus elevating his sentencing guideline range. As set forth in the brief, we spoke with Lisa Templin. Lisa Templin indicated that whole statement originated because of a confidential informant working on behalf of the police wanted her to go into this party at 2 o'clock in the morning and see if she could obtain a kilo of cocaine. She happened to know my client, Doug Martin. She talked to Mr. Martin. They had partied before. She had always bought small quantities of cocaine from Mr. Martin, and that they would then use the cocaine and they would party together. At no time has Mr. Martin ever been able to obtain that kind of quantities from this conspiracy. As indicated, he was a very low-level dealer, and the 500 grams that is attributable to him is completely out of character for my client, is completely out of the context of what the weight should be had. Now, at the sentencing, Judge Shabazz indicated, as I stated, that he said that Temple could obtain 500 grams. That was an erroneous statement. And I think, and it was set forth in a brief, that is an erroneous statement. But he also looked to other aspects of this. And he looked, for example, that there was a statement made by my client, Mr. Martin, to another woman, a Casey Beckwith, that if the government was so interested in him, how come they did not search a car when he returned from Chicago across the border of Wisconsin, and that they could have found a trunk full of cocaine. That statement by itself means nothing. I, again, went and spoke with Ms. Beckwith. The affidavit is attached to my brief, where she also indicated that she, on numerous occasions, bought small quantities from Mr. Martin. She knew Mr. Martin, knew that Mr. Martin was not capable of obtaining those large quantities, that he never obtained those large quantities, and that there was no way that she ever saw him with that amount. I think the government would concede that there was never a sale from my client of 500 grams or 1/2 kilo of cocaine, and that the incident with the party is not to be used for this particular purpose. What the government again is saying is the part is, was he reasonably capable? In addition, there was an issue in that was whether my client was the right-hand man of Victor Matias Jr., who was the head of this conspiracy. Well, let's look at that real briefly here. Victor Matias Jr. was in his 20s. He's Hispanic. All of the other co-defendants were in their 20s, were Hispanic. The conspiracy, we believe, went back as far as 1990. My client, Doug Martin, is a 49-year-old white male divorced father of two who was unemployed, got caught up in this lifestyle in late 1998. To try to imply that my client was the right-hand man is simply absurd. To indicate that he's anything but a small-time dealer is, I believe, also absurd.
So all the statements, references beyond the actual transaction, Mr. Dutch, are just puffery? Is that?
That would be my position. Certainly that is mere puffery. And in my brief, I lay out the Seventh Circuit case law that indicates why it's puffery. But I also indicated as to why he is not capable of making those kind of purchases. And the government, in its reply brief, uses these other statements to indicate that this is not that this weight that he could purchase it. But I mean, it's the 500 grams from this transaction, because those 500 grams are not attributable to anybody else. And I did have another argument, but I ran out of time.
I want to save some time for rebuttal, then.
Yes. Thank you.
Ms. Gale?
I'm Ralph Gale, and I represent Victor Mathias Jr. Victor Mathias Jr., in a sense at least, represents President Bush. Our position in this case is that the job of deciding who gets prosecuted is up to the executive, not to the judiciary. And that when Judge Chabaz rejected a plea agreement between Mr. Mathias Jr. and the government, an agreement that called for the discontinuance of prosecution on two counts, at that moment in time, Judge Chabaz exercised power that he is not given, because he exercised the executive power to decide who will be prosecuted and who will not.
Well, as a matter of fact, doesn't the judge have to accept the plea agreement before it becomes effective?
A judge has to accept a plea agreement before it becomes effective, but the issue here is whether a judge has the authority to reject a plea agreement where the essence of that agreement is, I'll plead guilty to this and the government will dismiss that.
The government has a right to dismiss the case without permission from the court.
The government has that right, but where the government enters into an agreement that allows it to exercise its power to discontinue prosecution.
The judge rejects it and then they don't dismiss it. That's not the fault of the judge. He's doing what he's supposed to do, isn't he?
It is. I think it is not what he is supposed to do.
You mean judges are required to accept the plea agreement as offered by the defendant and the prosecution?
I believe a judge has no authority to reject the plea agreement that calls for dismissal of counts upon the sole ground that the plea agreement is inadequate to get a long enough sentence to suit the judge.
What he said was he thought the plea agreement did not reflect the
serious
malfeasance of the defendant himself.
What he said actually,
seriousness of the offense, didn't
which is exactly the language of the sentencing guideline. He was quoting the sentencing guideline exactly.
Well, all right.
And he was exercising in doing so the power that the sentencing guideline purports to give to allow the judge.
Well, before the sentencing guidelines, the court still had to accept the plea agreement before any place, either state or federal, before it becomes final. A judge does not have to accept the plea agreement, as I understand it. And
that
spent some time in the business.
That would be true, but let's draw a distinction, because I think that really is, to some extent, clouding rather than clarifying the issue. Suppose we have a plea agreement, a kind that would be typical in many of the state courts, but I'll plead guilty to this and the government will recommend a particular sentence.
Right.
Without a shadow of a doubt, the government cannot bind the court in federal court. I can't think of a federal court except under Rule 11, the binding plea agreement provision. There's a difference between that type of plea agreement and an agreement that says nothing more than you plead to this count, we dismiss that count.
I think it goes the other way. I'll plead to that count if you dismiss that count.
I'll go with that. There is a case, and actually a case that Mr. O'Shea and I shared in front of Judge Chabaz, in which in a one-count indictment, Judge Chabaz rejected a plea agreement where the defendant pled to the count and the government recommended acceptance of responsibility because that person was not charged with a gun violation under 924C.
I agree that he can't compel the charge.
And we say, okay.
But in this case, he was already charged, wasn't he?
And that shouldn't make a difference, because there's no realistic difference between those two circumstances.
The difference is the prosecution gets to frame the charge itself, where the judge can accept or reject a plea to those charges already filed and already before him.
In this case, the judge rejected the plea to the conspiracy count, which plea was not withdrawn. At that point, the judge is taking no action to dismiss the counts the government has asked to be dismissed. He is refusing to do the dismissal. All that that agreement requires.
Pardon me.
Yes.
Until he accepts the plea agreement, there is no motion on the part of the state, the government, to dismiss it, because it's predicated on the acceptance of the plea, isn't it?
Yes, and the plea is made, and therefore the motion is active. And the point that I think is critical here is the court, in refusing to dismiss the counts, refusing to use your terminology to accept the plea agreement, is doing so for a reason. And that reason is, I can't give this guy the 30 years that
he deserves. Well, I admit it's kind of mean, but I want to know whether it's illegal.
Well, it's got to be illegal, because the simple fact of the matter is that if the government's got the power not to charge him in the first place, then the government's got to have the power to uncharge him.
Yeah.
And so the court should not and cannot...
A simple way to do it, of course, is to dismiss the indictment and re-indict him, or have a superseding indictment that leaves those out. That's one splendid way the executive branch can proceed. But
I would suspect in this case that Judge Chavez would have rejected any such offer. But the point here...
What do you do about it? If the government dismissed the entire indictment and proceeded with
he might be able to do absolutely nothing about it, or at least, let me put it this way, you might find the government up here on a writ if they had the courage to do that. The point, of course, is that it's the defendant's ox that is being gored in this set of circumstances by the government not exerting its authority, and it is the defendant...
I agree with what you're saying, but the point of what I'm asking is what you want us to do is compel a judge to accept the plea agreement that's been entered into in good faith by both parties.
I don't like to use the word plea agreement, because I think the thing that I'm asking the court to do is say that the court does not have the power to reject an agreement or a motion to dismiss charges that is part of that agreement, because the essence of it is dismissal, because it doesn't provide a long enough sentence. That's second-guessing a prosecutorial decision.
Gotcha.
That's a nutshell. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim O'Shea for the United States, represent the Western District of Wisconsin United States Attorney's Office. I prepared to address all the issues, but I'm just going to focus in on the several raised by the four defendants here today. Let's talk first then about Mr. Victor Alicia's possession of a weapon under 2D1.1B1. That adjustment, the two-point adjustment, applies whenever a defendant possesses a weapon in connection with drug activity, unless it's clearly improbable that the weapon was connected with the activity. Let's look at the facts here relating to Victor Alicia's possession of that weapon. He participated in the cocaine distribution conspiracy between 1995 and 1999. He distributed the cocaine, much of it, out of his Baraboo, Wisconsin home. He bought a 9mm satin finish Ruger semi-automatic firearm that has an attached laser scope on it. He showed that weapon to a man by the name of Adam Young. One time when Adam Young was at Victor Leach's home, the same place where they had numerous cocaine transactions. Adam Young, over a year's time, had purchased 20 ounces of cocaine from Victor Alicia. I would respectfully submit that the court was not clearly erroneous in deciding there's a reasonable purpose for Victor Alicia having this gun there in his home in the first place was to protect his cocaine proceeds.
What's the temporal connection during that 4-year period or the or with that, when to that display of the weapon, unless your position, as I understand, Mr. Shea, is since you know he had it once, you know he's got it every time you come to his house. Is that the position of the government?
Well, I can tell you that the record, the ATF records, show that Victor Alicia bought that gun in 1996.
So it fits in the conspiracy time.
Right, right.
So is the government's position that a drug dealer who owns a weapon during a 4 or 5 year conspiracy, and if it ever becomes any buyer, let's say there are a dozen or 120 buyers, any time any one of those becomes aware that, let's say there's a shotgun or a rifle in the home, that would constitute a sufficient basis for the court to act as it did here?
But I believe in that instance the court would not be clearly erroneous.
Do we have a case in this circuit that approaches this case factually, let's say, as far as a connect between a display of a weapon and a sale, either a single sale or multiple sales in the case of the individual you speak of?
Well, there's a case that I represent the United States on in Zehm, Z-E-H-M. And there, as I recall, the weapon was never displayed to a customer.
Just the knowledge.
It was just possessed by the defendant during the period that he did it. But I want to talk about, you know, in terms of the temporal thing, I want to focus in it, and I want to make quite clear that it was during the period that Adam Young was Victor Alicia's biggest customer, cocaine customer, that Victor Alicia showed him that gun. Okay, and this wasn't the movie they were watching, but it brings to mind the movie, the Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr. Strangelove, where one of the messages in that movie is that weapons-based deterrence only works if the people on the other side know you have a gun. So I think Victor Alicia reasonably wanted to get the word out. Don't even try. You know, look what I've got here. You know, don't even contemplate stealing my cocaine or my drug proceeds. Let's talk a little bit, while we're on the subject of the guns, let's talk a little bit about Melvin Alicia's gun, because his gun possession ties in with his argument concerning the obstruction and so on. Melvin Alicia, during the period of time he was involved in the conspiracy, bought 13 handguns and one rifle. And he showed, his attorney Berman indicated, he showed a semi-automatic handgun, again with an attached laser aiming device. Apparently this was an option that was popular with the Alicia brothers. But he showed one of these guns to a cocaine customer. Okay, further, during the summer of 1997, Melvin Alicia was participating with other group members in a discussion where they talked about killing an informant who'd approached a group member wearing a wire. And it was Melvin's idea to kill the person. And in fact, that summer, June 20th, 1997, a man by the name of Michael Sutton had bought a little more than 3 grams of cocaine from Melvin Alicia. About a week later, Mr. Melvin Alicia approached Sutton in the bar. And he said to Sutton, I heard you said something. And he threatened, he warned Sutton, that's a good way to get a bullet in the head. Now, in light of the context, you know, where Melvin Alicia had purchased 13 handguns and he'd shown one of them to another cocaine customer, I respectfully submit that in the context of that threat, that Melvin Alicia was not talking about using his thumb and shoving the bullet into Sutton's ear there in the bar. At least talking about putting a bullet in one of his 13 guns and shooting Sutton in the head. And that was a very clear warning. And that is the basis. You know, in light of that, I don't think the judge was clearly erroneous in finding that Melvin Alicia possessed these guns in connection with the conspiracy, and also that Melvin Alicia had obstructed justice by behaving as he had.
Those 13 guns were purchased also during the time of the conspiracy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Between 1995 and 1997. Next on the list here is Victor Alicia's obstruction. Mr. Hunt talked about that a little bit. The district court was not clearly erroneous in finding that Victor Alicia had obstructed justice. Both the district court and the magistrate court affirmatively found that they did not believe Victor Alicia when he took the stand and testified that he never gave consent to search his home, and the officers never asked him for consent to search his home in connection with his motion to suppress evidence, where, coincidentally, the gun that Victor Leach had, again, that 9mm Ruger, was found. So I guess that highlights the point that Victor Leach never stopped possessing it until the police took it away from him. Victor Leach's testimony was directly opposed to the testimony of Special Agent Bile. Special Agent Bile clearly said that, you know, Victor Leach gave him consent after asking, and Victor Leach denied it. And the district court and the magistrate court both disbelieved Victor Leach. And that decision is not clearly erroneous. I think the defense counsel is, I think, for stretching to say that the district court did not find his material. I quoted a section of the court's written order where he clearly found it material. To be material, the statement need only tend to influence the issue under determination if believed. The district court wrote in his order that if the district court had believed Victor Alicia, he might well have decided the issue differently. So it can't be more material than that. Let's talk a little bit about the Sixth Amendment. Victor Alicia's argument that his Sixth Amendment rights of confrontation were somehow imposed. Mr. Hunt said that Ms. Quinn, in fact, requested that the testimony be stricken. I didn't see it in the defendant's attachments. I checked his brief and looked back there with his attachments. It's not in there. If it's anywhere, I'm not aware of it, and the defendant did not in fact attach that. But that's all sort of beside the point for a bunch of different reasons. The question whether or not Maldonado told officers that he sold cocaine to other people, apparently entirely unrelated to the case, is clearly collateral. Further, Maldonado abandoned his Fifth Amendment rights, as I've indicated, on redirect, where he said, yeah, you know, I did tell the police that I sold cocaine to these other people. Ms. Quinn had the opportunity to follow up, and she chose not to. And she didn't need to, because she argued in her closing argument that, in fact, Mr. Maldonado had sold cocaine to these other people, and maybe he's getting such a great deal from the government he couldn't be believed. And, of course, Maldonado never actually bought any cocaine from Victor Leach, so to the degree his Sixth Amendment rights are implicated at all, it's quite minimally. And as I've indicated in my brief, you know, Maldonado was thoroughly impeached by both the government and then the other lawyers. He admitted he used cocaine, he admitted he sold drugs, he admitted that he sold ephedrine to a person, he admitted his two drug-related convictions, testified he received benefits from the government, and that he was testifying in hope of avoiding prison time. I mean, the guy was pretty impeached and pretty darn well. And, of course, Ms. Quinn's question was called for inadmissible evidence anyway. The question was whether Maldonado told the police something. That clearly hearsay, and it's clearly improper impeachment under 404B and also 608B. So I respectfully submit that is not a terribly big problem. Matthias Jr., his argument is about the plea agreement and whether the district court appropriately rejected the plea agreement. The district court clearly was entirely appropriate under Sotomayor Rule 11 and the sentencing guidelines in looking at Matthias Jr.'s sentence, saying, look, this guy's minimum guideline sentence is 30 years imprisonment. The current plea agreement caps him at 240 months, 20 years imprisonment. The plea agreement, as it stood, would have mandated that the court essentially give the guy acceptance of responsibility that he palpably didn't deserve, and prevented the court from accounting for Mr. Matthias Jr.'s obstruction of justice. I respectfully submit that it could not have been abuse of discretion on the district court's part when he rejected the plea agreement that would have severely undermined the guy.
Did the government move at any time to dismiss those counts of the indictment that were covered by the plea agreement as not to be dismissed?
Well, the way it works in the Western District of Wisconsin, Your Honor, that if there would have been a movement, that would have been at the end of sentencing. We never got there because the district court...
So the answer is no, you never moved.
Never did, Your Honor.
You could have.
If you appropriate time, yeah, we could have.
Could have any time. Any time is appropriate for the government to move in the interest of justice to dismiss an indictment.
Right. And Mr. Kalil referenced whether or not the United States Attorney's Office has the courage to take on Judge Shabazz, and quite frankly, I'm not sure we do in many instances. But let's, the question is whether Mathias Jr. would be the appropriate candidate for the United States Attorney's Office to stick out its neck for. We've got a man here that pled guilty and admitted to a slew of things, and then the next week gets on the stand at his buddy's trial and says the direct opposite. This assistant wouldn't be sticking out his neck for Mr. Mathias Jr. He got ultimately the sentence he deserved under the guidelines. Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Martin's drug amount flat, and I respectfully submit that Mr. Dutch perhaps misunderstands the fact in certain ways. The district court was not clearly erroneous in finding Martin's drug amounts for three reasons. First of all, Mathias Jr. distributed over the 5 years of the conspiracy 7.7 kilograms of cocaine. During the last year of that conspiracy, Martin was described as his right-hand man, not described by the government, but described by Mathias Jr. as his right-hand man. And the 500 grams is a conservative estimate of what was reasonably foreseeable of Mathias Jr.'s distribution during that year that he was a member of the conspiracy. Now, then the conservative estimate, I respectfully submit, is corroborated by Martin's statements himself. Now, essentially what Martin would, his defense to this is, Mathias was just kidding when he called me his right-hand man. I was just kidding when I said that I was driving back with a trunk full of cocaine, and I was just kidding around when I was talking about getting a half kilogram of cocaine from Mathias Jr. I respectfully submit that the district court was not clearly erroneous when they take Mr. Martin at his word, but let's explore.
Or else the district court has no sense of humor when you get kidding around.
I don't know the answer to that, but let's...
Probably doesn't.
Well, let's turn then to the conservative estimate Mr. Martin's statements are corroborated, or how they corroborate. Mr. Martin told Laura Freitas and Catherine Beckwith that he took trips with Mathias Jr. to go get cocaine. He also said that had the police stopped him at the right time, at a given time, they would have found a trunk load of cocaine. Now, while discussing a possible drug deal, and this is an important distinction that I think was lost on Mr. Dutch, a possible drug deal between Lisa Templin and Mathias Jr. Lisa Templin went to Mathias Jr.'s right-hand man, Mr. Martin, to sort of get advice on how this would work. It was never an attempted drug deal between Douglas Martin and Lisa Templin, but rather she was talking to him to ask him, you know, how this would work. At that time, Martin said that the most he could get at a time from Mathias Jr. was a half kilogram. The most he could get at a time was a half kilogram. That demonstrated Martin's prospective ability to get 500 grams of cocaine at a time from Mathias Jr. and also reflects the historical fact that in the past he had obtained 500 grams of cocaine from Mathias Jr. In light of Martin's year-long participation in this conspiracy, in his own statements, I respectfully submit that the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding that Martin's relevant conduct was more than 500 grams. If there are no other questions from the court, I would ask the court to affirm the court. The
All right, thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Mr. Hunt?
How much time in total?
There has to be some standards, some evidentiary standards that the government should comply with when they want to enhance for a gun. Now, the prosecutor engages in a very creative argument where he mentions the movie Dr. Strangelove. I think he's seen too many movies, because what he should have done at that evidentiary hearing is put the question right to Mr. Young, did he threaten you? Was this connected with a drug offense? No. As a matter of fact, if this gun was so connected to the drug offense, why didn't the prosecutor put Mr. Young on the stand at trial and bring out that incident? Because it had no relevance to a drug offense. Because the prosecution in this case did introduce evidence of guns
not against Victor Alicia, no mention of Victor Alicia being involved in guns and threatening. So that just seems to be out of sheer cloth. I don't know if I've run out of time.
You haven't run out of time, but you're sharing it with the other three.
Oh, all right. Well, just to be very brief, in terms of the obstructing, to clarify something that the prosecutor said, Judge Shabazz used the word material, but I still fail to see how it was. He didn't analyze it. And without findings of fact and conclusions of law, it's hard to reach the conclusion he did, and I say it's error. And I ask you to reverse the conviction because I think his right to confrontation was violated, and also enter an order remanding it for resentencing because those enhancements shouldn't have been applied. Thank you.
Mr. Dutch? Ms. Berman, all right. Mr. Dutch?
Briefly, my client never admitted that he was the right-hand man. In fact, the person who indicated that he was the right-hand man was the confidential informant by the name of Stiglitz. So I'm not sure where that is coming from. The 500 grams that we were talking about that the government is saying is not some 500 grams just taken out of thin air. This has to be foreseeable. The issue has to be what is foreseeable to my client, Mr. Martin. That 500 grams is based on that transaction that never took place in that party that happened in January of 1999. And to now indicate that that since Mr. Martin was with Mr. Matthias Jr. for the last 6 months to a year is just being disingenuous as an argument. That 500 grams was from that sale. I would ask that you, for Mr. Martin, modify and reverse the sentencing. Thank you.
Carol, you may have a minute.
If we're going to take the position that there isn't a separation of powers problem until and unless the government actually moves, then all we're really doing is finessing the issue, because then the defendant, once the plea agreement is rejected, would have to move for specific informant performance. That seems to me to be a futility, to ask a court to enforce specific performance of a plea agreement calling for dismissal of count after the court has already rejected the plea agreement.
Have we got any cases that have accepted this approach?
If I had, Your Honor, I believe it would be cited in the brief.
No, it doesn't mean you should.
You probably would have thrown it at me while I was asking questions.
Your Honor, it is my sincere hope that it will be this case that establishes that precedent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel, and I want to make a special thanks on behalf of the court to all appointed counsel in this case for so ably representing their defendants. All right.